This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. This week, we're considering feedback for Season 1, Episode 8, The Missing Piece. Respect and enjoy the podcast. All right, Aaron, how's the feedback looking this week?
Oh, we have a mighty bag of feed that we need to consider. People sending stuff to foundationofbaldmove.com and stuff we're going to consider in this podcast. But first... I renamed the segment. It's no longer the Conception Inception. It is now the Goyer Foyer. This is the entryway to our podcast, or if you like the British pronunciation, the Goyer Foyer.
Yeah, I like that.
For people to come through the podcast and consider the official thoughts of Goyer and his team of writers, as moderated by Jason Concepcion over on the official podcast. Also, we got another email from David this week.
Nice.
Talking about our coverage. So we got a couple things in the Goyer Foyer. Do you have any points you want to talk about? We both listened to the official pod. What'd you think?
Yeah, I took a couple of trips through it because I background listened the first time and it didn't really stick. Second time through, I thought it was interesting that something I hadn't considered when I watched the episode the first time or the last week. Is that maybe Day possibly wouldn't have killed Halima, or at least had Demerzel kill Halima, if it hadn't been for her kneeling at the ceremony the previous episode. I guess I hadn't even thought that there was any way that she would have gotten out of this, but it seems like maybe that was a factor based on what they said.
I know we engaged in a little bit of this kind of talk and speculation, but yeah, even from Demerzel's perspective, when she was like talking to Empire after the deed was done, she was kind of like, I don't understand. You'd already beat her.
Yeah.
And then he came back with the Imperius. Just because you don't comprehend it doesn't mean I have to explain it. It sounds to me like this is an uncharacteristic decision for him. It's uncharacteristically. Because like we even said, like, man, he's really soundly beaten Halima, mm-hmm. but he's also kind of let her have a hand up, you know, like, I destroyed you theologically, but I never would have done it if it hadn't been for your inspiration.
Sure, it seemed like that, man, was the case.
That's a great way to, like, you know, punch somebody down, but then also, you know, maybe pretend turn them into a potential ally. Now, I think Halima is too pure.
Yeah.
In her, you know, spiritual politics to for that. And maybe Empire would have done it anyway. But I kind of think you slash David are right that if she hadn't knelt, like, the very least, he wouldn't have made Demerzel do it.
Yeah, you know? that's the thing. Jason said this was like an assertion of dominance, essentially. Like,
yeah,
hey, I see, like, there are some around the edges things here where you are maybe more invested in this religion than potentially serving the Empire. I'm going to make sure that's not the case and test the limits of my power over you, essentially. And boy, yeah, when you add that layer to it, like, this is not only a fuck you to Halima, I'm going to kill you even after beating you, but it's really just like we talked about how tough this is as a follower of Luminism for her to go in and kill Zephyr. I mean, that's one angle, but the other angle is, like, yeah, he's doing it only because she showed her loyalty or allegiance to the religion in the first place. If she hadn't have done that, if she had have just stood next to him without kneeling, he might not have had her do this. That's just, yeah, I hadn't even thought about it. It's wild.
But it might, so it's like, it's also hard to separate what is personal versus non-personal motivation for someone like Empire, because sure, you also can see the very real concern he had when he's dealing with her about, like, are your imperatives working? Mm-hmm. You know, Like, are you still 100% loyal to the Empire? And this was a way to test that, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, I'm pretty sure she doesn't want to kill a bishop of her church, or an archbishop of her church, essentially. The like right well, below the
these
the
are the consequences,
of,
right? We talked about, like, yeah, what are the consequences going to be for this? Essentially, a huge transgression in my eyes when she yeah. kneels. And these are the consequences, right? This is not just a test of his power over her. This is also a reminder to her of that power and to step back in line, right? It's there are two layers here.
Yeah, and I wonder when you say, like, it's not just a test. I don't even know what it means to humiliate or put a robot that is programmed for loyalty back in its place. Like, and like right. clearly... even from Goyer's omission, there's not there. You know, he sees the robots of Asimov as more soulful than a lot of the human, you know, because a lot of times, you know, frankly, Asimov wasn't that, I think, interested in the human motivations of some of his characters. They're just stuff for him to play with science fiction idea. Whereas the robots obviously fascinated by their potential and how, you know, they are intertwined, but also separate from humanity. And they don't experience emotions like us, and they've got these drives to be like, you know, they're almost a perfected humanity because they have like everyone's right. best interest in mind, and they're selfless and all this kind of thing, you know. So, but even then, it's like I don't know. Like, it's weird for it'd be like me putting my Keurig in place because it told me mm-hmm. like I was desperate for coffee one morning and it said add water. Fuck, yeah. I got a fucking add water you before you dispense caffeine. I don't know if you're still loyal to the whole caffeinated agenda here.
Right. So you dump a pot of water on it. Yeah.
But you're also like, if you connect the lines where, cause Goyer said in another podcast that he thinks that like, Empire, like one of the ritual or one of the things that inevitably happens in the Empire Demerzel relationship is they consummate a sexual relationship. Mm. So it's like, I don't know what it looks like to fuck your Keurig either. There's clearly a lot of like mommy Oedipus type stuff bound sure. up into this. So it's like, yeah, it's not just any one thing, but yeah, what does it mean to yeah also yeah what does it mean to put your mom slash lover slash appliance into its place? Like, there's just tons of layers to this whole thing, it seems like. So a lot of this was just like practical behind the scenes stuff, which I find it fascinating, but it doesn't really tell us much about the world itself.
Yeah.
Or the show itself, you know, like him fighting over a particular cave or this particular location and what it meant and his inspiration for different pilgrimages that this is based on, like the Hajj and, but one thing I thought was interesting is that, you know, this is back in 106. Where Empire was a much more kind of a subservient relationship to Demerzel. You know, he's eating a little bowl of soup and he's being, you know, flashcarded by his mom about this thing. They mentioned it in the set there's in the shot list, you know, when they're looking at the stuff, there was nothing about that. There's a little prop of this, birthroot flower on Demerzel's, makeup desk, whatever you call that, credenza.
Mm-hmm.
And he noticed that there was never like explicitly a shot that like, you know, the inset shot of that thing. And I guess they got through all the filming of that day and they realized, oh, they had that one shot, but hey, it's not that big a deal. And Goyer comes flying in. It's like, no, we have to get this shot of the Empire considering the birth. And I went back and watched it because I didn't even notice this, but like,
right.
Not only does the camera focus on the birthright flower, pans up to Demerzel noticing Empire looking at it and then becoming lost in thought to the point where he doesn't kind of follow what she's saying. And she has to recall it's clearly like two, three episodes ago, they laid this birth root thing. And I thought that was cool. The kind of the small details that you have to sweat when you're doing a show like this. And there's another one. I guess it's appropriate to include in the Goyer foyer, the email that Mr. Goyer sent himself. He said, You guys are wondering why Eskel, who is the other, the elderly pilgrim that's on the pilgrimage with the Empire, says you're going to wonder why he doesn't recognize Day as the Emperor. I've always maintained that he does recognize him, but because he's religious, he goes with it and welcomes it. Prior to that, Day was swathed in rags, etc. So many other people didn't recognize him. You know, like we said, why would the Empire be there? All these different cultural contexts that we're missing. But he says, I think the Eskil realizes he's walking with the Emperor and embraces it. And just for shits, I went back and watched the first couple scenes of them interacting. And when Empire goes to blow past this old man, he kind of does a double take. And like there is like an unmistakable both flash of recognition. And then I think what I can only identify as like some kind of smug acceptance of like, even the Empire, even the Emperor is down with my religion, you know, kind of like if you're a very devout, you know, member of a certain religion and you find out some other powerful word figure like President Xi, for example, you know, as a Foundation fan, you would feel a little puff of pride in that. Right. So it's interesting that like I think all this stuff is kind of scripted, or at least it came through out of conversations maybe that the guy who plays Eskel and Goyer had. I thought that was pretty cool. This is what we call in the industry biting the bullet when a podcast says, is it unrealistic that this guy, and you spend 5 minutes talking about how it's not, and the creator's like, oh, nah, he fucking recognizes him.
Yeah.
You got to respect that. Anything else in the Goyer foyer before we transition from the opening to the entryway and we get into the podcast proper?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay. Well, we'll consider all of your guys' great feedback right after this brief break.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Okay, we're back. Again, if you want to send feedback into the show, foundation@baldmove.com is the one and only place where that stuff trickles into the podcast. I did get several people wondering why we spent so long entertaining the theory. There's an alternate theory about, you know, Gale plus Raish equals Salvor.
Yeah.
A guy put forward like a Harry plus, I think her name's Lowry. The Asian lady that had her zygote harvested equals Salvor. And it's like, why did you spend so much time considering whether a white man and an Asian lady can have a black woman for a child? And I'm like, oh, man, that is kind of stupid because that's the ultimate disproof. But then I thought about it more. And this weekend, especially, I saw going around on Twitter a black couple, a black man and a white woman who had, among other things, twin daughters, obviously fraternal twins. One of those daughters, I would can say, is stereotypically white, blonde hair, blue eyes, light skin. The other one, I would say, stereotypically black, brown skin, brown hair, brown eyes. I'm just saying genetics, like we're just, you know, if traditionally, except for the last, you know, 100 years or so, we've kind of been all siloed up. And I don't know exactly. I mean, I've seen for sure like a redheaded kid shoot out of a family tree that had like a great grandfather had red hair, you know, four generations ago. Like the Punnett squares, man. Who knows? I guess I'm not ready to dismiss Jerry Harry and this. I looked her up. She's from the Philippines. I guess I'm not ready to dismiss them as having like a Salvor-esque. Yeah, I don't know how many generations back. I don't know these people's family tree. Maybe it's not crazy. Yeah,
maybe the technology on the genetic stuff is not nearly as good as Empire. Maybe they can get the perfect clones, but then, you know, you're mixing in. You just got a stew, a whole stew, just a big pot.
Eight trillion people that all came from a single planet, moving to different planets with different environments, you know, fucking this and that and the other. And it's probably it looks like, you know, 21st century, you know, the world, only much more so. So
everybody
anyway,
except Lewis was getting laid there. That's all I'm saying.
Especially especially when we're talking about like sci-fi fantasy stuff, you know, because they I feel like they play with like genetics anyway. Like it drove me crazy. The Game of Thrones, the seed is strong business. Like, you know, Robert Baratheon has super sperm that just destroys blonde hair and blue eyes in the zygote. Just goes with the sperm has little tiny warhammers and just smack. I don't know. Anyway, let's move on to the first real feedback from Scott. Says, I was slightly disappointed when you were comparing Harry Seldon to early and late Dumbledore that you didn't make the father and son connection. I did not know. I was this years old until I realized that Jared Harris is the son of Richard Harris, who was the original Dumbledore.
Okay. I'd never seen the movies. I don't know anything about them. So
you've seen Gladiator, right? Richard Harris is the old emperor that dies. Well, I guess he's killed in the beginning of Gladiator. And he's like a very famous storied British actor and Jared Harris descendant. So apple didn't fall far from the tree, but I didn't know, Scott. So thank you for letting me. That's fucking blew my mind. Allie says, as of yet, I'm not understanding those crying foul with Seldon's inclusion of specific individuals in the predictions and machinations. While it's true that psychohistory can't predict actions of individuals, it does seem plausible that Harry Seldon as a man could, especially considering individuals with whom he's had close personal relationships. For example, you can reasonably predict how your partner will order their coffee, how a close friend will interact with others at a party, etc. It makes sense then that Seldon would be incentivized to take advantage of this, setting the chessboard as much as possible in his favor with players he knows, understands, and can within limit predict on a purely interpersonal level. While he can't use math to map either Gale or Lewis's actions, his model may include something like the Foundation needing a strong leader early during a crisis, a role he can then decide from personal experience Gale is well suited for, while Lewis is not. Obviously, his ability to identify and influence this would become more diffuse when events become further removed from Seldon's own life and experience, though I suppose Hollow Seldon may be able to wield this level of intervention to some degree moving forward. Yeah, this keeps coming brought up in the podcast, like the fine differences between individual action and collective effort. And the thing is like, more and more, I guess I see both sides, right? You know, like, because, like, even if I take Allie's email here at straight face or straight value, whatever I'm trying to say here, at face value, what did Harry actually know about Gale? So I absolutely believe that Harry Seldon threw this wide net at this math contest, and in his probability, he's like, you know, whoever comes out of this math contest will be useful for, you know, X, Y, or Z, maybe for this, you know, for vouching for the trial. It's a little bit harder to believe that he would be able to surmise from the person successfully doing the math contest that that would also be the person who's best able to lead the foundation. And by his own admission, all the precognition, he had no idea mm-hmm. was going to happen. So, like, but on the other hand, I feel like I would like to give the show some opportunity to play around with this concept of psychohistory and the great man theory versus the bottom up history of or way to look at history, because, you know, I think that a lot has changed in the world in the last 60, 70 years. And, you know, they can incorporate new things like, you know, cloning, and they can integrate some of that robotic stuff where it might not have been well integrated beginning foundation. They can, like, look ahead at, like, things that may have been like a deus ex machina in book 3 and start laying the seeds in book. Like, I guess that's what separates me from the Asimov purists that I see online losing their shit. Mm-hmm. Is that they just don't seem to think that there's any way you can deviate from the source material and still be true to its spirit. Do you feel that, or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's something that I even struggle with. I'm like, I think to the experience that I've had reading the books or reading that first book. And then I look at the show and I'm like, well, these experiences aren't very similar at all. One of them is much more focused on the people involved in this organization, and the other is structured around the organization itself. But I'm giving it time to get there, right? Like, that's the thing. The show is going to take its time. Now that I sort of know what the map is for, like, seasons mm-hmm. to books and all that, the show is going to take its time. But I do feel like they're getting around to all of the highlights that you want from the book, because the book is a series of highlights. That's what it is, right?
Right.
And so, like, I don't feel like it is a downgrade to fill in the gaps. And I don't think they're going to change, like, the big picture stuff here too much.
It's certainly we can already see that they're not. It's certainly too soon to say, like, oh, this deviate. Because, like, I can't think of how many times when we were covering Game of Thrones
mm-hmm.
that, like, book people were shitting their pants around episode 6, 7, or 8 of any given season, thinking, oh my God, this guy's doing that instead of this guy. And this guy's an amalgamation of this girl and this lady. And if they do this, then there's no possible way they'll. And then almost every single, like, yeah, they play jazz in the middle, but, like, almost every end of a Game of Thrones season, they were ready to throw the ball to season, you know, season 1 to season 2 to season 3. Even those minor changes, they were able to collapse that so that the integrity of the story was able to hit those, you know, crisis points, right?
Sure.
You could still hit all the climax. Maybe not in exactly the same way, but, like, you know, looking back, things were different. But when you look forward to the new season, you're like, oh, I can kind of see how this is going to, you know, meet up and head into the third book, even though you arrived at there a different way. And I think that I'm inclined to give that freedom to Foundation as well.
Yeah, the more I see of this show, the more I think that's what they're doing. They're getting around to the big stuff, but they're setting a lot of smaller stuff in motion here, right? They're setting a lot of tone and a lot of, like, character beats, so you care when these things happen because they're happening to people that you know. I think it makes it richer. Like I said at the beginning of this show, if they can pull off hitting the big highlights that the books hit, plus adding a whole bunch of character texture in there, I'm all for that.
Yeah. I think at the end of episode 10, we'll be able to see, oh, how this is going to meet up with some of the other sections of the first book. And and if not, and the other thing with a story, because, like, Game of Thrones is a lot more straightforward than this story. Like, you didn't have massive time jumps. Like, mm-hmm. Martin wanted a 5-year time jump, but that'd be modest compared to what we've already seen in this show.
Yeah.
Like, I'm almost prepared to give it 2 seasons. Like, I won't panic if at the end, until at the end of two seasons, like it looks like I don't see how they get back to the book map from here. And even then, I'm only going to panic if I'm not enjoying the experience.
Right, right.
Like if this happens to be like a more inspired by Asimov's Foundation and it takes the core concepts and does something interesting and relevant to, you know, it's like, it almost feels like this. Like imagine if someone is a big fan of the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, that original historical work from like 200 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they hear that this weird scientist is adapting that for a science fiction project. And they're like, what the fuck? Where's Cleopatra? And Mark Anthony's nothing like this Harry Sel-. Like, you know, yeah. Like it's an adaptation that Asimov was doing to say something interesting about the time he was living in and what he saw for the future. Well, we're 7 years past that. So it's only appropriate to continue to adapt that. So, because again, I know we talked about this in the previews, the Foundation series is a pretty dry intellectual exercise.
Yeah.
That would be a hard pitch. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but that's not me saying it's okay that they can do whatever they want with the Asimov stuff. You know, I think there's a happy medium and we're a ways away from seeing if they've achieved that.
Yeah. Hopefully that answers your question about predicting individual actions. We got pretty far afield from that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Seawells, clearly the Emperor is flirting with all types of sunburn. Good heavens, he's going to have to keep that force field on for another 4 years and pray skin cancer doesn't set in.
Those nanobots will take care of any errant cells.
It feels like it, yeah. It's just permanently search and destroy for cancer. He says this guy went full Frank Abagnale, that's the guy from Catch Me If You Can, and tricked the entire religion into giving him a hall pass, then sent Demerzel into Zephyr's room and gave her some poisoned dove lotion. What a great episode. Does this mean the Empire has no purpose because they're on track with an end because the Empire is failing? Or did he not get a vision because he legit has no soul and Halimo is speaking the truth? Or is it both?
That's another thing they were talking about in the official podcast this week. I think the creators are under the impression that he does have a soul, just as Demerzel has a soul, in whatever way you define that. It's not necessarily that he doesn't have a soul, that he doesn't see a vision. He just didn't see a vision. And they compare it to, like, you know, when someone, I think it's Liz Fang is the writer who was on the podcast with them this week. And she said, think of it like, When somebody tells you, hey, I did meditation for 2 weeks and I saw God and it'll change your fucking life. You need to come meditate with me. And you do it for an hour and nothing happens. Yeah. You're just like bored and you fidget and you look at your watch. Yeah. That's the experience the day is having. It's not that you meditate and you don't see anything, so you don't have a soul. It's just that it didn't happen for you in that moment.
I saw an interview with Tania Miller, who is the lady who portrays Zephyr Halima, and she had an interesting take where she's like, I think the Emperor has a soul. He's just at the very beginning of his spiritual journey.
Right.
Which is exciting to think about in terms of, you know, to the extent that this is an analogy to the fall of the Roman Empire. We talked about that last week, how there's a, you know, you might have a schism and there might be an Eastern and Western half. You might have an emperor that converts to a new religion that changes the course. Like, it would be interesting if the emperors become kind of like a religious institution, kind of following, you know, and like Emperor Constantine, that like maybe not this guy, maybe not the current Emperor Dawn, but like a Cleon a generation or three from now with all the religious fervor he's no doubt stirring up, you know, might have this like a much more overtly religious empire as a way to stave off, because like clearly this is him trying to be like, oh, you know what, Harry Seldon, fuck you, you're gonna tell me that these are crises, I'm gonna say they're opportunities to be even stronger. And you know, I think you're gonna have 8 seasons of Empire twisting itself into a pretzel trying to keep the regime going and getting increasingly more desperate, increasingly further from the vision of the original Cleon, and struggling and futilely against that destiny. But it's kind of a cool idea to have this kind of technocracy. I don't know how you say technocrat democracy. Technocracy.
Sure.
To have this technocracy like subsumed into some kind of religious Theocracy. And I think if I recall correctly, they play a little bit about with that in the books, like how you can use religion almost cynically to like inject these memes, these ideas into a civilization quicker. Like, you know, yeah, you could educate and explain and rationalize people, but sometimes it's a lot easier just to grab a hold of the monkey, the lizard parts of the brain and squeeze, you know.
I'm super interested to see where the Luminous stuff crosses paths with the Foundation, if at all. Because that could get interesting.
Yeah. And clearly they're doing something about the merging of these religions with the Empire taking this, you know, having this vision and all that. But yeah, I don't think it says it seems like the show creators are pretty unanimous that this isn't a referendum on a soul. It's more a referendum on how open he is to being spiritual.
Yeah.
Now, I did see another couple people that seemed like they misinterpreted. Like, this is like a cool take. I just think it's wrong with Demerzel saying, I pity a person that saw no vision because that's such an empty and meaningless existence, and that she was talking about herself. But like, she also speaks in this episode how it's the most beautiful thing she's seen, how it changed her life. I don't think sitting in an empty void, shivering in a pool of water meets those. So like, I don't know. It seemed like a lot of people are trying to make sure that Demerzel is not anthropomorphized, you know, like, yeah, how can a robot have a vision? I don't know. Like, I honestly don't. Like, that's a crazy thought to me, but something happened in her brain that made her see something that changed the course of all history, it seems like. So let's move on to Scott. So just listen to the last recap. I want to throw out a thought on Demerzel. I enjoy the three rules of robotics and how they can be manipulated. And thinking about the Emperors, we know that Demerzel can never hurt them because she's a robot and cannot harm a human being. But Demerzel may not view the Emperors as human due to her religious viewpoint. Additionally, with the Kleon referring to themselves as Empire, if Demerzel has been given a vague directive such as protect the Empire, she could choose to interpret that broadly, so broadly as to protect the actual Empire, not these meat bags. This could help explain the faulty cloning of the most recent Empire. So I may be waiting for the reveal that she's working against the Emperors and in support of Harry's plan to protect the Empire as much as she can, although I hold out hope that she is a bloodthirsty robot looking for revenge and will be the anti-Harry, setting up two masterminds to go head-to-head in a psychohistory battle. No, and that's the thing, is like, we are in the dark about the motivations of Demerzel, which is why I get frustrated when people get very dogmatic about what Demerzel can and cannot do with regards to the laws of robotics, with regards to her imperatives of serving the Empire, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, interpretation is always a good question, because that is kind of left up to her. And I guess I sort of read, as I've been thinking about it more and more, the thing she says to him about, you know, that being empty is a dig at him. I think it's like, you made me do this terrible thing. I'm going to give you a little bit of grief, give you a little anguish over not seeing a vision because I know you stole my vision.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is maybe actually her vision that she saw. Like, she keeps this birth fruit around as a reminder of that vision, is my guess.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything explicitly saying that, but that's kind of what I thought. She, like, he literally stole her vision. It's not like he just picked up on context clues about the religion and then used that. He did do that stuff to construct his own vision, but that was her vision.
Well, so I don't know that I agree with that. I don't know that I disagree with it either. But like, I heard for the first time someone advanced that. But I wonder what the interpretation. So if she literally saw a birthroot flower, like, you know, assembled, like, what would be the interpretation that means something to her? Because this is
good question.
11,000 years before the genetic part of the Imperial dynasty would begin.
So yeah, like, it wouldn't mean anything.
Yeah, but it has to mean something.
Well,
right?
It wouldn't mean anything. Yeah, related to the Emperor, the same way that it did to, you know, if Kleon were to have that vision, That would make a lot of sense for him. But yeah, what it would mean for her.
Yeah, I mean, the religion has a lot of trinities already, you know, the three moons, the three goddesses. So there's already, and I guess these birth roots were something like, you know, the fig leaf or the olive branches that the doves brought back to Noah. And that's how he knew there's dry land, you know, like the fact that this plant was growing on the maiden let them know that it was, you know, that it's the cataclysm's over and they can start repopulating it. I wasn't sure if I assumed that her vision was related to the birth route or like that was like a memento she took of her journey, because apparently back 11,000 years ago, this path, the spiral was a very different affair. Like it was covered in vegetation and flowers and shit. Like, I had a bunch of questions about that. Like what kind of cultural drift happened where like, was this used to be like a park and it wasn't like a grueling thing and it's become that as the moon has been devastated by God knows what they've done to it in 15,000 years. But
yeah, there's going to be people talking about living in California in the 90s versus living in it in the 2040s. Sure. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. When it's on fire all the time. Let's move on to Byroa, who says, I have a couple things I want to talk about. First up, Asimov's laws of robotics. The discussion regarding Demerzel's motivations and actions in context with these laws ignores an elephant in the room. There's apparently a war of extinction fought between the robots and humans. I don't know how we can assume Asimov's laws are applicable given this history unless we assume it was a one-sided war with the robots not defending themselves. Despite Demerzel's line about being unable to act against Empire, this seems like a big hole if we are to assume the laws exist or apply. Before we answer that, I saw a lot of confusion in the fandom where some people are saying, oh, well, there is no three laws of robotics in this because this team was unable to secure the rights to the robot series. They've got the Foundation and Empire series, but they don't have access to the characters and rights of the robot series. And Goyer clarified this on his AMA on Reddit 3 weeks ago. He said, Asimov's robotics laws, this is a direct quote, do exist in the universe of the show, but that doesn't necessarily mean Demerzel is presently bound by them. And to explain further would spoil too much. I think he's actually talking about this episode.
Could be.
Because there is. So, like, how do we round that? How do we square that? You know, if there was three laws of robotics and they've been with the robots the entire time, how is there a war between humans and robots?
I mean, I always figure if there's a war between humans and robots, the humans are going to lose. They're going to get their asses handed to them.
Doesn't seem that's the way it works out in science fiction, though, you know?
We're pretty optimistic about our own capabilities, I think, compared to our creations. I don't know. I could definitely see a one-sided war. I could see a thing where, like, the robots provided no resistance and it was a war in name only. I don't know.
Well, yeah. Cause like, it reminded the first, when I saw this person's email, I thought to the Animatrix, you know, the animated prequel to the Matrix. And if you remember that, like they go into the prehistory of like how robot and human, you know, became inimical to each other, became, you know, enemies. And my recollection of this material is we started it pretty much 100%. Like robots, you know, were able to usher in this golden age of humanity. But and this is something maybe you want to sit up and pay attention to, because not all the rewards were distributed evenly throughout the population for this boon of automation. There was the haves and haves nots, and the have nots, the ones that were replaced and didn't have jobs and were felt made to feel less than the robots, started abusing them. They started to be scapegoating them and started attacking. And initially the robots were just like, you know, hey, we don't can, you know, if you're going to fucking extinct us, can we just go and start our own little nation? And they tried to do all these things to be left alone. And only in a last ditch self-defense did they fight back. I can easily envision a universe where the robots are kind of meek and mild and won't hurt humanity, and humanity, just because, you know, the automation creates the haves and have nots, turn against the robots and destroy them, even as the robots are passively accepting it.
Yeah, it makes sense. And if I guess they don't fight back, that wouldn't really matter. I mean, you know, a war can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people, right? Probably depends on what side you're on. A war might mean a country comes in, just totally thrashes and invades and kills and takes everything. The other side would probably see that as a massacre, a genocide, right? It wouldn't be a war to them. It'd be a human rights violation.
It
the war might be a misnomer, maybe.
Yeah. And the other thing is, like, I guess some people might say, well, that's how the law started. We beat the robots who weren't fettered by those laws, and then we put them in place. But that's not compelling to me.
That's not really how it works in the Asimovian universe, right? Those are rules that are there from the beginning of the creation of the AIs, right?
But if you want to posit that they're not, yes, but it's intrinsic to the way the positronic brains work that these laws are in it, and it's like foundational to their consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you want to say that, well, that's not true, like, it doesn't make sense that you annihilate a species and then you put restrictions on them, and then there's only one, like, if they're incredibly useful and you can fix them with the laws of robotics, then, like, you won the war, you imposed mental servitude on them, why would you continue to wipe them out and oppress them?
Sure.
You go back to, like, well, then you got, you know, non-violent, non-resisting robots being purged anyway. Kind of like, and in the same way that, like, you can also see this in iRobot, the Will Smith, even though that's a really bastardized and twisted version of Asimov. Those robots meekly accepted obsolescence when it's time for them to go, like, sit in cargo containers. That's clearly not their preference, but they were told to do that, so they did it in en masse. So, I'm very skeptical of people that are loudly proclaiming after 8 episodes what Asimov's robots can and cannot do, because there's just no fucking way they've read the full breadth and scope. I haven't either, but, like, just, you know, from what I have read, like, that's the whole point of the robot stories, is, like, you know, these ethical quandarums and dilemmas that robots can get caught up into, and what are the exceptions, and etc. Byroa had one other point, said, on the new clone Emperor Dawn, we wouldn't necessarily have to have the current Dawn die to decant his replacement, explore the possibilities discussed. He could also run off with Garden Girl Azura, and that would necessitate his replacement in the Holy Trinity. Bonus points if he gets her pregnant with the ET extra testicle, and his questionable reproductive status results in an infertile offspring. Which, if you're a book series reader, that goes interesting directions. The thing is like, I don't know. I feel like the show told us that that's not going to happen. And if it was going to happen, it would you'd have to blindside the other emperors. And I feel like Emperor Dusk already kind of has a bead on this guy.
I still think there's a risk that Dusk or Dadon is going to run off with Azura, right?
I think it's a risk, but I think they get killed. I think that.
But what are they doing in the meantime? They're not going to wait. They're not going to be like, oh, maybe he's, I don't know, out back. Maybe he's over in the woods hunting.
But I'm just trying to think of, like, what does that plot even look like? Like, she pushes a laundry cart up to his quarters and he piles into the dirty. It's just like, you know, like a fucking hackneyed action 80s TV series plot. You know, like how do you get him out of the royal palace? How do you get him on a jump ship? How do you get him to another planet? He's one of the most right. You know, like I felt like the show did a pretty good job of her being hopeful that that could happen.
Yeah.
And
he's
just like, no. Then I think they might try it because they're clearly kind of a Romeo and Juliet thing. I just don't think it's going to succeed.
Okay.
I would be very surprised if Emperor Dawn does not get replaced this season.
Me too.
I feel like that's starting to lead up to, like, maybe a season, not cliffhanger, but, like, the hammers, you know, like the, like, fuck things that you get on some of these shows where.
Yeah, when you've got the Shadow Master skulking around, picking up on little details. Yeah, he's in trouble.
Counting lizards and this, that, and the other. Yeah. J-Cubed has some problems with the inconsistencies that they're seeing in the space jumping. Because if the Anacreons don't have jump capabilities, how the hell did they find the Invictus when they first saw it jump? The Invictus literally could have wound up anywhere in the galaxy. Even if it had a jump relatively close, how could they possibly locate it? Ferris shooting the, let's start there. I got some ideas on this. What do you think? Like,
this.
What's your understanding of how Farrah found the Invictus?
I actually don't know exactly how they found it.
Because they talked about scouts. Like, so mm-hmm. this area of space seems like it's the border of the borderlands, right? Like it's way out in deep space. It's at the border of Anacreon's domain and Thespian's domain, because we know that within a matter of hours, the Thespians can summon a huge fleet here. Presumably within a matter of hours, the Anacreons could do the same thing. And just because you don't have jump mm-hmm. drive, I think they've established in a show, doesn't mean that you are reduced to slower than light travel. It's just you don't have the instantaneous cross the galaxy in a blink of an eye capability. You might, you know, take years to travel from the middle of the galaxy, like took like Harry's ship 34 years to work its way through the space lanes and whatnot. That's way faster than fucking speed.
Yeah,
hell yeah. the Milky Way galaxy is like 100,000 light years wide. At light speed, it would take you 50,000 years to get from the middle to the edge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know they're not doing that. I feel like it's just within my believability that Farrah's scouts were in this kind of like hiding out in this abandoned asteroid field, minding their own business, trying to think of how they are going to best strike at the Empire. And like she said, delivered from the gods themselves, boom, Invictus. And then it became a matter of where is who knows how to work this shit? Because we certainly don't. Oh, Terminus is also happens to be in our backyard. They've got a bunch of scientists and engineers. Let's go raid and pillage. So I feel like it all works out.
Yeah. I mean, if your hang up here is the universe is a large place and the likelihood of it appearing near Anacreon is approaching zero, you're right. But it happened in the story. So like, I don't know what to tell you. If you think that coincidence can't happen in a good story, then I don't have a rebuttal for that. I would just say that's not how I feel.
I mean, here's one. Like, one time a guy went to assassinate a political leader and got all confused about where he's going to be in a parade route.
right.
Dejected, wandered off to the nearest pub, ordered himself a sandwich, ordered himself a beer, sat there at the window thinking, how did I fuck this up? And at that exact moment, that political leader drove on by in his motorcade, mm-hmm. and the guy ran out there and blew his brains out as the Archduke Ferdinand. And that's how World War One started. Yeah. Like, what are the fucking odds that the bar, this guy's pub, that happened to be the route that the guy drove through? Now, you know, that's all the roads in one city.
But yeah,
versus. But it just goes to show sometimes, like, you know, shit happens. Mm-hmm. And like fair is like it does. It seemed miraculous. So even the show's not saying like this was some kind of clockwork plan. This was an opportunity. And the fact that like they had no idea, they just knew they had to act fast. So like the fact that some of this plot didn't maybe seem particularly well thought out, or the fact that she lost three of her warships and doing like that makes sense, because she's just kind of her and Salve are actually very similar, both very young, haven't really come into the fullness of their powers and responsibilities, are kind of making shit up and flying by the seat of their pants. But yeah, the show didn't make it seem like it was a big clockwork grand conspiracy. It just literally fell into her lap. They had no idea how long it's going to be in the system, so they had to act now. And I think they can schlep around fast enough that didn't they say that the jump cycle was going to be a couple weeks, it turned out, or something like that?
Maybe, I don't remember.
So it wasn't like 24 hours. That would be like, what the fuck? But they had time enough to scrap together some ships and go after the scientists, so... they also said Farrah shooting the Imperial captain seemed really dumb for more reasons than even them potentially needing him again. They prove they will immediately kill someone the moment they are no longer of use. Mm-hmm. What is the motivation to continue to cooperate? To kill someone.
Buy yourself time. I mean, that's always the motivation to cooperate, right? Is if you have no intention of actually helping them, you buy as much time as possible to give yourself an opportunity to get out of the situation until it's apparent that one is not going to appear, and then I guess you just resist.
And the quote Farrah, I don't think you're grasping the point of revenge. Like, she's really pissed off at the Empire in a way that she's not pissed off at the Foundation people, so maybe these nerds will think that they're safe because they're not an Imperial with Imperial blood flowing through them, and, you know, they're not part of the oppressor class. But also, I think the next email dovetails nicely into this topic. Josh M says, I believe they're telling an origin story in parallel to the one that's already taken place. We've been following Salver and the Grand Huntress, and it's very clear that they are one in the same in regards to seeing the ends of their mission or their purpose. Grand Huntress says that you do not know what it's like to want revenge. She's hell-bent on seeing her mission complete. Then you have Salvor, and we see how devoted to protecting the Foundation she is. She'd not hesitate to be killed if it saved everything and that she ever knew and believed in. This is because both these characters have been formed and molded through their upbringing and things beyond their control. So now you have Salvor determined to be okay with her fate and protecting the Foundation at all costs, since this is all she's ever known. It's almost her faith she must see to the end. You contrast this with Gale, who has 100% tried to make her own path and change her destiny to prevent her vision of her homeworld being destroyed. She's been told time and time again that her decisions have actually been her destiny all along. Her special cognition does nothing but confirm to her that she is on a designated path that she'll never be able to get out of, which is why she's never brought it up and tried to hide it away from her mind. She finally gets her time with Harry Seldon to hear what his plans are. After being traumatized, seeing him die and her lover send her away, she realizes how much of a tool she's been in this grand plan that she's never signed up for. This, I feel, is Harry's fatal mistake. He never knew about her special ability, never accounted for her being part of his plan in any way that could derail it or help it in the long run. She's only seen as a hindrance. How insulting it must be to find out that you were left behind to lead the first Foundation and then be told it was only meant to be a decoy to the real Foundation. It's confirmed to her how expendable she was and something she never agreed to. I don't know, because like, it's still unclear to us, I think, exactly what the second Foundation was supposed to do. Like, it seems to me that both of them, if I do a plain reading what Harry said in this episode, both of them are vital to the success of this project they're trying to do. So it's not like one's less important, one's just more clandestine. So, you know, which is more important, the secret agent that does the spying and steals the nuclear secrets, or the diplomat that is able to leverage that information and get concessions from, you know, another nation? Like, they're both important, right? Soldier, diplomat.
Yeah, sure.
Different missions.
It's crazy to me the situation we're in, because Gale was supposed to be leading the Foundation on Terminus. And now, presumably, Harry didn't figure Salvor into the equation much at all.
No.
So now she's kind of leading that, especially if what we think happened to Lewis actually happened to Lewis. So, I mean, he's probably dead one way or another, but like, yeah,
either space madness or gut wound. Yeah.
Right. So I guess what's the status of the second Foundation now? Cause Harry was desperate to have her stay. And I mean, we're one Foundation leader short of a two Foundation system currently. And the one Foundation leader that does exist doesn't want any part of it. So we have zero Foundation leaders for two Foundations.
Sleep. Uh-huh. That's what it seems like.
How is he going to reconcile that?
But this is, it could be that the show is having Harry, because like, Harry's not like this in the book, right? But I think it's interesting to have Harry be a little myopic, or maybe not have full faith in his own system that he tried to micro engineer and put individual, like there, he tried to stack the deck a little too much, and when really he just needed to trust his formulas and his numbers and his methods, you know, trust for. So I don't know, because like him calling, like it seems like him calling an audible has led a lot of chaotic ripples throughout the cycle history. And I think the show is aware of this. So I think they're going to do something interesting, like showing that like actually cycle history is so strong that all the shenanigans doesn't matter, because like it might plus or minus in a few years, but like what's happening is inevitable. And you know, once the Foundation started getting emotion, but the second Foundation, to directly answer your question, I think is on a ship that's on flames, that's about to be torn apart by the heart of a dark star.
And even if he does make it to Helicon, who's gonna set up the second Foundation? Because that was clearly Raish's job.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like something Harry could do by himself as a hologram.
Yeah, like, hey, I'm the AI construct of one of your most famous, inhabitants. I think that he was definitely counting on Raish to be his human contact to kind of make all that stuff happen and grease all those wheels. And now that he doesn't have it, now he is, I think, in large part on that knife that Gale took with her in the cryopod.
Mm-hmm.
But like, what does it do to his psychohistory plan that the second foundation doesn't get started for another 137 years?
Right. Yeah.
Ultimately, or is he going to be able to get some kind of half-ass second foundation going with just himself and the hologram, you know, and Helicon as a hologram? I don't know.
All good questions. I like your analysis of the two characters there, though, Salvor and Gale.
Yeah, that they're like, you know, the different sides of the same coin as far as their upbringing and their sense of mission and purpose and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, Josh had a final prediction where he thinks that Gale is 100% the missing piece of this episode. She is the very piece that could have helped the Foundation go to greener pastures and solve problems or crisis to come in the future. Instead, she's going to go back to her home world, see it destroyed, and be just like the Grand Huntress, only this time I may be on Gale's side. Harry even says he should not tell her about the Second Foundation because of how unpredictable it all is, yet he does so anyway, without realizing it's already too late to win her over. She's going to come back into the future hell-bent on destroying Harry Seldon and his work to prove herself that she is able to make her own path. I've heard a couple people suggesting that maybe Gale will be a villain for the future, and I kind of like the idea.
Yeah.
Or she goes back 137 years to her homeworld, and they've gotten their shit together, and they've successfully mitigated the problems, and that renews her hope in, you know, humanity's long-term ability to plan and overcome, and she starts a second foundation at a handicap, but her precognition helps her like get up to speed very quickly. But from where it is, like the second foundation just seems like it's kaput.
It kind of does. Yeah. Here's the difficult path I think they have ahead of them. In some of the stuff that we talked about earlier, right, with staying faithful to the book while also injecting a lot of characterization and texture to this story, the events that happen in the books are all necessarily controlled, or you know, the impetus of like large groups of people and swaying public opinion and like the more political style maneuverings. So for Gale to become a villain, how many antagonists do you think this show is going to have? Because Empire is an antagonist at the moment. You've got the Anachrons who are antagonists, and all these antagonists roughly exist in the book, that first one. The wild card here for me is Gale. And I think you can tell these stories, but like, you don't want this to become too personal, right? Because if this is just like Gale's on a mission because she doesn't want to be part of the Second Foundation and she is pissed at Harry, and so she's going to try and tear down the Foundation, that doesn't feel like Foundation to me. That doesn't feel like the way things happen in Foundation. They happen, like I said, more on a macro scale. So that's the road they're going to have to walk, and the kind of tightrope act they're going to have to do here is keeping these characters from feeling like they are the motivating force, the driving force of this plot, and keeping the big stories from Foundation in like the driver's seat, I guess.
I agree. I think that's going to be, and that's the thing is like, I'm even giving them to like the end of second season before I start being like, oh, they're just not doing the Foundation plot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying we've gotten to a point where I'm concerned about that. I'm looking ahead, and that's the road, that's the path they're going to have to walk. And that seems like a tough thing.
Well, we got more Gale theories, more speculation, more analysis from your fellow fans coming up right after this brief break. Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We're back this time with Kelly. Says, "Heyo, I thought I'd jump in on a prediction action regarding Gale in Season 2 of the Foundation. Been thinking more about the sleeper religion and Gale's involvement. We know from flashbacks that she was an acolyte and about to be tapped for the priesthood. We also know that before the religion got big, her parents were friends with the professor, and that her mother had told Gale stories of other planets and cultures. We also know that even after leaving her home planet, Gale still believes in religion. She visited the temple on Trantor, seeks guidance, and still practices prayer and the like. One of the biggest parts of the sleeper religion are the seers. I'm not sure yet if the priests are supposed to, or all priests are supposed to be seers, but I do know that they make a big deal out of them. Enough so that Brother Dust seeks out the priest on Trantor, putting his own life at risk just to ask if Gale is a true seer. At this point, I think we can surmise she is. I'm going on record saying that I believe Gale will go back to Synax and be seen as the sleeper. She gets there in a cryopod where she's been quote-unquote sleeping. She'll have the power of a seer and be able to help them overcome their environmental problems. Gale will then bring about a new age of enlightenment on Synax, and if she has Harry with her, she can build the second foundation there. I think this likely as multiple shots point to the knife being key to Harry's sentience." I like this theory a lot because it's got a lot of stuff. Like, imagine Gale, who has literally been asleep for 165 years at this point, emerges at a Synax that's just getting back on its feet, rejecting religious fundamentalism and embracing science. And here's a literal sleeper who is this math whiz who is going to be famous and could be seen as kind of like this savior, like a person that can meld both of these disciplines together. And what could Harry do? Yeah, he's 137 years behind, but that's a fucking head of steam you can build with. Now, well, it's nothing like... Go ahead.
I was going to say, depending on, you know, his status, is he stuck in this knife for 137 years or is he running stuff from Helicon? Because he might have 137 year head start.
You could have two seeds. Harrys, couldn't you?
You could have an
one that's been
Harrys.
Fucking around in Helicon for 137 years, one that blinks to existence on Synax out of the knife, not knowing about the other. it's interesting. And there's also still the sneaky kind of thing that like Harry is lying, because Harry's lied to Gale to manipulate her before, and that he did know about her precognition. And this is everything he's doing is goading her to do the thing that he needs her to do. Now, you're starting to really fuck with that gray zone of psychohistory now, but...
Oh, sure. Yeah. I love the idea of Gale just being who Gale is and accidentally or unwittingly setting up a second foundation. Because the thing about Gale is she trusts the science, right? She trusts the math and the numbers, and that's... Her whole life has been that. She's a curious, intellectual person. So... If she comes back to Synax and she starts creating an organization, you know, to rebuild this civilization, she might inadvertently become the second foundation by just leaning into the predictions of psychohistory, because she almost has to, right? She'll be compelled to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially since we remember in the second episode, she was getting into the psychohistory cube and she kept on saying there's something missing here. Mm-hmm. Like the calculations aren't complete. I'm starting to think that the second foundation was the thing that Harry deliberately hid. And, but like, if he did that, he had to have known that Gale would have found it, because he knew that she would eventually master psychohistory and could see the missing piece and would be able to draw the conclusion from the shape it left behind. So maybe I'm starting to talk myself back into Harry is like this puppet mastermind, 3D chess player. 4D chess player that has engineered this whole situation, and it could only have happened this particular way.
Maybe.
So again, I we'll have to see how the show squares that, and you know how it shades in some of these gray areas. But let's move on to Ben. So David S. Goyer mentioned that this was his favorite episode, this eighth episode, and I can see why. It's got lots of heart. I really like the parallel journeys into the unknown that both Gale and Salvar are on. My only gripe is deals with the technology aspect of the series. In this episode, we see the Hugo plug in what appears to be a wire to the communication beacon. A wire, like an HDMI cable? We're at the stage in current humanity where everything is now becoming wireless and contactless, so the need for a wire seems out of place. I'm also bothered when the Empire is getting tucked in by the sleepers. They attach wired medical-grade monitoring devices. It's not the first time I've had this thought. Back when I saw the foundation on Terminus for the first time setting up, I saw the main center, or in the main center, I saw chairs were clearly from IKEA. It just seemed completely out of place given when this is set. Hasn't stopped my enjoyment of what's been a really solid and compelling season. I'm just curious if you guys have noticed these details, and if so, what are your opinions?
Look, that Malm line is pretty popular. I think maybe in 13,000 years, we might still have it.
Yeah, flat pack shipping, you know, It's the way, even if you got jump drives, it's just the most efficient way to pack furniture.
Yeah.
I'll say this. If this bothers you, stay the fuck away from the Expanse.
Right.
Because
zero AI. Yeah.
It turns out that we've seen the future, and it's sustainable flat pack Swedish furniture.
That aspect. Yes.
Yeah. Because there is so much shit in the Expanse that's just IKEA stuff, because it is high tech, and it looks still a little exotic, I think, you know, that the design is not traditionally, you know, kind of Western furniture design. But as far as wired versus wireless, as a former IT person, I would be deeply skeptical of all wireless. And like, if you don't have a way to hard jack into something, like even R2 fucking D2 had to essentially put his little, like, you know, robot finger into a wall socket and get stuff, because it's just his robo dick. Is that what you're trying to say, Jim?
Yeah.
Trying to run a family show here. I think that, yeah, because you're all, if you have a wireless thing, you always are dealing with one more moving part that you wouldn't have to if you just plug directly in, you know?
Yeah, I don't like know about you. I've literally never had a Bluetooth device work correctly 100% of the time. Never, never. It doesn't matter what the device is. My Wi-Fi router included, like Wi-Fi doesn't work 100% of the time. I don't think that's going to change in 13,000 years. I really don't based on my personal experience.
yeah, like you always have to worry about interference. You have to worry about like if the machine's working, maybe the antenna's bad. You know, this is an installation from 50 years ago. Maybe they changed the software. Like, you know, but serial port's always a serial port. Ethernet's always Ethernet. Now, again, you could say 14,000, 15,000 years in the future, they've solved all that and they have some kind of super duper reliable technician, you know, and all that. And there again, like the Expanse, I'm always like, anytime you got someone with one of those future cell phones and they flip an image onto like a memory board, you know, where Avasaral is, you know, or like Prax is doing that in season two, throwing his daughter on a missing person. I'm always thinking, like, who is moderating this that people aren't just throwing up pictures of dicks? And you know, political propaganda and shit. Like, is their dick pic sensors so work so well that they just can't do that? Or you know, what is? But yeah, it's just a completely open wireless. Anyone can throw shit up there, and it's crazy. So that doesn't bother me. I like that. Feels yeah. All else fails, you want a cable. You want to be able to plug into something. You don't want to have to fuck around with wireless and interference and transmission ranges and all that stuff, but that's just me. And the IKEA stuff, like, again, like, there's a lot of shows that you know, if you are into, I don't know, any kind of like hobby, like what was it that there was like a popular rescue flashlight that Westworld was using for future flashlights, and it's just like something you can order. I mean, budgets are limited, man. You can't have like fully customized shit for every chair and desk, and some of that stuff is just coming from a guy sourcing things. And I guess I'd rather it be IKEA than Ashley Furniture. I don't want to see a sectional sofa just chilling out in the middle of Terminus, you know?
No.
I don't want to see a Lazy Boy.
Mm-hmm. At the very least, I hope we can get rid of Barrel. That fake leather that just crumbles and falls apart after a year. Just let's get rid of that and I'll be happy with all future furniture.
Yeah, immediately starts delaminating. Let's move on to Brett. Says, Dimmerzell said she walked a spiral 11,000 years before. If I remember, that's almost the same age as Luminism that Brother Day had mentioned previously. Might have misremembered, but if true, could Dimmerzell have had a hand in starting the religion? Perhaps as a way to control pieces of the Empire to her will and further her own motives. Interesting thought, if so. Really fascinated by her character and the control she has over the Kleons. I actually went back to look at that scene because I wasn't sure myself. And it's 15,000 years Luminism has been in the public consciousness, whereas the Empire has been around for 11,000 years and the Genetic Dynasty, 400. But that's still, in relative speaking, that's still closer to the beginning than... And also, like, you know, there's big differences. Like, the spiral used to be a lush place with flowers that grew on it when she was walking it. So, could she have had a hand in starting it? Could she have had a hand in adapting it and subtly influencing it to, you know, her inscrutable ends? I think that's an open question. What do you think, Jim?
Maybe. I don't know. 4,000 years is a hell of a long time between the start of a religion and when she got into it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm making an assumption that 11,000 years ago is when she got into it. She might have been a Luminist for 4,000 years and just never had the opportunity to walk the spiral.
Right. And I was thinking, like, in terms of Christianity, you went from this, like, Jewish cult to Mormonism. And you can do it. You can make a direct connection to every single step that took you from, you know, this guy in the early first century to his second coming in North America, preaching to the Indians and whatnot. Like, you can, the Native Americans, sorry. You know, like, yeah, what weird shit could have started from, especially since this religion was born in a cataclysm. It sounded like, you know, two planets smacked in each other, made these things. They were all uninhabitable for thousands, who knows how long. Like, that sounds like there's that religion's rife for a lot of change in the very beginning, much like Christianity was. Like, the first 300-400 years, massive upheavals, you know, massive amounts of heresies and false messiahs and, you know, spurious books of the Bible. It took them a long time to get together and kind of like come up on, and then they had that going for a couple hundred years, and Martin Luther started, you know, hanging shit up on doors, and it just continues to, so, like, what are the offshoots of Luminism? you know, is like a Sunni Shia thing where you've got different, you know, like there's a lot of Muslims, but how many, you know, there's different types, and probably got liberal versus conservative luminists. Like religion, anytime you get in that, it's, you know, that's like a purely human construct. It isn't bound by any kind of like universal laws. So who knows? All right, next email is from Matt. It says, one thing that keeps coming up with Foundation is, how does psychohistory deal with things it can't possibly know about? I want to share a description of that problem from another series that sometimes deals with it. It's called an outside context problem, a problem so far outside the context of your experience that you can't quite predict or even prepare for it. Forgive me for quoting in full from Ian M. Banks' Accession. This is, of course, if you're familiar with his works, part of the Culture series, which we'll be talking about here in a minute. He says, an outside context problem is the sort of thing most civilizations encounter just once, in which they intended to encounter rather in the same way a sentence encounters a full stop. The usual example given to illustrate an outside context problem was imagining you were a tribe for a largish, fertile island. You tamed the land, invented the wheel, or writing, or whatever. Your neighbors were cooperative or perhaps enslaved, but at any rate, peaceful, and you were busy raising temples to yourself with all the excess productive capacity you had. You were in a position of near absolute power and control, which your hallowed ancestor could hardly have dreamed of, and the whole situation was just running along nicely like a canoe on wet grass, when suddenly this bristling lump of iron appears sailless and trailing steam in the bay. These guys carrying long, funny-looking sticks come ashore and announce that you've just been discovered. You're all subjects of the emperor now, and he's keen on presents called taxes, and these bright-eyed holy men would like a word with your priests. Thought you guys might like that. Soft pitch, if you're looking for something to read, the Culture series by Ian M. Banks is really good. Touches on subjects that have come up both here with Foundation and also Westworld. Things like robot consciousness, human mind transfer, or backup, cloning, etc.
Speaking my language.
I have in the Cincinnati Public Library system a hold placed on the first, it's called like Consider Thermopolis or something like that. I forget. But it's the first book in the Culture series.
Great. I like this email. I'm not going to be able to get it for 8 weeks.
Yeah, because you know I'm going to keep it for 16. I don't think you can. No. You can't, unlike a real library book, you can't just not return it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just eat the late fees on those digital ones. I like this. What'd you think?
It's a cool idea, and it makes a lot of sense. How do you predict stuff? It's an unknown unknown, right? That's sort of a similar concept.
Yeah, and the fact that I think that's the cool thing about the Foundation is they take some stabs about like how would you do that? How could you mm-hmm. design a system or a plan that's, you know, rigid enough to maintain cohesion for 1,000 years, but flexible enough to come up with things like these out of context problems. Anyway, we'll see how the series adapts. We have a transitional email. There's two more left. We have a transitional email. This one is like not about book spoilers, but it's asking us to surmise our opinion of book readers on the series and what the reaction is on that. So here's the part where if you're just a show purist, you might want to start heading to the doors, because why the fuck do you care about what book readers think about the series if you're enjoying it? Because the next one after that will be a little bit bookish. So foundation@baldmove.com is where you want to send us feedback. We will have another episode ready late Thursday night, perhaps early Friday morning, when Jennifer Apple deigns to send it into the ether. But we'll catch up with you back then with the new episode, episode 9, the penultimate. Let's transition again lightly. This isn't book spoilers. It's meta book spoilers, but it's a good speed bump for everybody. Josh H says, doing a podcast on the show, as you do, do you have a general impression about what big fans of the books thinks of the show? I've seen a lot of complaining on Twitter. I don't know what this is, but it's not Asimov's Foundation. But that's a very that's the very place unhappy book fans would go to complain, even if they're in the minority. I know you've looked around and you've been on subreddits and stuff. What do you think? Do you got a temperature of like what the big book fans are thinking?
Yeah, I feel like you're right on with the Twitter stuff that you've seen. I think this is very divisive. The people who appreciate Asimov's stuff in the Foundation series probably appreciate it for different reasons than you're going to appreciate the show. And so I can understand why people might be put off by that. That said, personally, I think it's a very good show. you know, and it is being about as faithful as I would want, about as faithful as a show could be and still be a show that I would want to watch. Because I can tell you, I don't think the direct adaptation of Foundation is an exciting watch. It's a very intellectual sort of a higher brain read, but it is not something that's exciting or emotionally impactful or visually interesting, even. Like, none of that stuff.
Yeah, imagine if the Cosmos series by Sagan and later by Neil deGrasse Tyson, imagine that, but science fiction. And that's literally what Foundation is. It's science fiction written by an actual scientist wearing a bolo tie, mutton chops, looks like a real fucking nerd. Cause he was. Those don't consider themselves as much with the human stories. But I have seen some book fans that are intrigued by what's going on here and see the interesting stuff with the robots and the Empire and the clone dynasty, and says like, okay, if this is the prequel to Terminus, then I guess that's not a bad. But it's also, I feel like there's a lot of posers out there that are acting like they're giant Asimov fans, and maybe they've read a book or two, or maybe they read it back, you know, 30 years ago, like I did, and they don't really remember it, because I'm just seeing wild takes, like people seeing episode 8 and be like, oh, we're a robot killed somebody. There's no effing way this can be at all an Asimov book, or, you know, Salver Hardin isn't an experienced administrator when we first catch up to her. This is not my, right. I mean, I just don't know how serious to take that, because I've read a lot of Asimov, not a lot of recent Asimov, but his stuff is all about like what if type questions, you know, like what if a planet that's surrounded by a complex quaternary solar system that's never seen light except for once in a, never seen nighttime except for once in a thousand years, the planet aligns to where you get a night. And like, what the, or maybe it's been, what does a civilization do that's never seen darkness deal with darkness? And how do they flip the fuck out?
Yeah.
It's full of stuff like that. And it's like, it's almost like anti-Asimov to be like, how dare you like not literally follow word for word? How dare you play with these concepts? How dare you adapt them and put cloning? Although I got to say, almost everyone thinks the Empire stuff is dope.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's even the people that are.
It is the most interesting part of the show so far. But I feel like it's all just ramping up, right? I don't think anybody complained if in Asimov's book there was a chapter of Hardin as a young man, right? Like, no one would say this doesn't work and it doesn't belong in this book if they were adding layers to Hardin so that you understood why he was making the decisions he was making. You know, it's not in the book doesn't mean it's not good.
Yeah, that's where I keep saying it's like, and it's weird because like everyone likes the Empire stuff, which is the biggest deviations, quote unquote, from the books.
Right.
And I feel like the stuff that's most closely adhering to the books, like, you know, this Invicta storyline is definitely a plot line in the books. It's a little puffed up and made more exciting. Uh-huh. The Terminus stuff. But the Terminus stuff is still close. But again, like I think Goyer said, I'm not sure it was, I've read so many damn interviews with him now. I'm not sure if it was ours or the AMA or what, but he says that, like, you know, you understand that this is like 20 years. This is just frontier town of Terminus. This isn't the big, you know, thing that it like becomes, and Hardin's not the person that she'll eventually become. But since it is closest to the books, like, people tend to fucking lose their mind.
Yeah.
Where the stuff where he's just, you know, they're just stitching stuff from whole cloth. They're liking that. So I'm like, I don't know. Because, yeah, I think the Empire stuff is really, really good. But of late, I've really liked the Gale stuff and the Harry stuff and the second Foundation stuff that they're exploring. Surprising to me, but it made a lot of sense. Instead of saving this for the really late reveal, why don't we start building the seeds and laying the fountain? It's like, this guy spent like 2-3 hours talking to Apple execs and pitched them on an 8-season series. And we're just at the beginning of the remix effort. So
and I think all of this stuff has been enjoyable. It's been good. I think one of the reasons why people like the Empire stuff so much and maybe not as much the other stuff is because there are a lot of sci-fi concepts to play around with in that and not so much in the other chunks, right? Like you got the vault, but it's been kind of sidelined for a while now. And we're just dealing with this Invictus ghost ship, which I think is a super cool, like once they got to what is the Invictus and how did it operate and how did it get here and what happened to the crew? All that stuff is super fascinating to me. But the Empire has always been like clones and force fields and shit that like sci-fi nerds love, right? So I can see why if you're a big sci-fi fan and you come into this and you go, what are the parts of this show that I like? The Empire's natural draw. It's got the politics that you like from a lot of the Asimov Foundation book, and it's also got some really cool sci-fi concepts.
Yeah. And even like I've been thinking about some of the problems, quote unquote, that I've had with the series, like, you know, like what the fuck did they forget the jump drives make people crazy on the Invictus? Like that stuff always tends to kind of get handled to some extent or another. And like when I think about the things that haven't, like it's just very minor things that probably are explained by COVID protocols. Like, I don't know why this scene was blocked this way or why there's 200 guys shooting a gun and like nobody taking hits. Well, let's get to the book spoilery section. This is J-Cube. He had some thoughts up here, but I broke this off to have a little discussion. Apparently, hopefully everybody who is not interested in some light book stuff has left. All right. Okay. J-Cube says, this show is causing me some frustration due to it seemingly contradicting the book. You have talked a bit about the great man theory, but so far it feels like the Selden plan hinges on just that. On the book, it's quite the opposite. The great man, Salver, specifically calls out that this is the first Selden crisis. How is that even a concept Terminus should be aware of? Have I missed something, or shouldn't they be still under the impression they are merely creating this Encyclopedia Galaxia? That wasn't anything on their radar until after the first Selden recording from the Time Vault.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm going to have to... Okay, because I wasn't sure. I haven't read the books for a while. I wasn't sure if they did not know that there was a crisis ahead of them.
This is why I'm not 100% sure that I know what's in the vault yet. Because in the book, Harry Selden comes back after like 50 years or something, and they open the vault opens, and he tells them there are going to be a series of crises ahead of you, and you're going to have to navigate those. And he doesn't really like influence the outcome of any of that. You know, he's not like a... He is a hologram, but he's not a hologram that's like actively doing things, right? He's not running inside of a ship that's floating out there, influencing Gale to make a second foundation, at least not in the first book that I've read.
These are more just message like, messages in the bottle exactly. than an active AI.
Yeah. So that's why I'm not 100% sure what's in that vault, because it seems like they've already done that, except Harry hasn't shown up to anybody yet. He hasn't appeared and told anybody about these crises. They seem to be fundamentally built into whatever organization he's building, whether that's this political, this technological, this religion-based thing, whatever it is, he's already told them about the crises.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I guess I'm curious to see what's in the vault, because depending on what's in there, I'll kind of either like, oh, okay, I see how they're going to start pounding this back into the foundation shape, or it'll be like, I just need to let go of my expectations,
right?
Because they're going and telling a much more different story. And I don't know, because I keep on comparing this to like other things, like, you know, Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, and how it mostly hewed really close, except for things that like just wouldn't work in the books or on the film, like Tom Bombadil and even Expanse. Like, remember how different the first two books were from the series?
Yeah.
But like when you read them, they both felt of a piece, right? They're like spiritually connected. You could tell. Even though characters are compressed and POVs are compressed and timelines were altered. And I remember there's a lot of people hewing and crying from the book side of that, like, oh my God, they're just butchering Holden. Holden's this. And oh my God, Bobby's terrible because blah, blah, blah. And Amos is. And it's all like people just fucking relax by the time season 3 and 4 rolled around, because they were nailing it. They were doing what needs to be done to make it a compelling adaptation. And that's what the. I mean, there's that much bitching and moaning when the two authors were directly involved in the project. Asimov's dead.
Right.
So, Yeah. Anyway, I'm curious to see like how much of a funhouse ride we're into, because once we get to the vault, we'll probably have a lot to say. Well, I have a lot to say. Jape Cube continues, by this point, I'm a bit underwhelmed with Terminus's scale. What is there, like 50 people left? Seldon went to Terminus with 100,000. True, but again, they're trying to capture the very early phase of the Terminus project. We're not, you know, the book doesn't catch up with Terminus for another 20, 30 years of development. So they are jumping the gun with some plot lines and retarding others. So it's hard to tell. Hard to tell. He says, Terminus also seems fixated on unlocking the Prime Radiant so they can view Seldon's plan. While in the book, Seldon made it clear that the plan depended on Terminus not knowing what he had predicted, so their choices would not be influenced. It's entirely the responsibility of the Second Foundation to subtly steer events to keep in line with the Seldon plan, as well as fine-tuning the plan. I read the trilogy prior to the season starting, and I've read the sentiment of Reddit on Reddit of those who read the first book during the season, and it seems common to those that have had a negatively affected how they enjoy the show. As a PSA, I would strongly recommend to any that are thinking about reading any of the books to not do so. Despite my gripes, there's still things that intrigue me, like the Imperial drama that is completely missing from the books, and the seeds of the Second Foundation. Production value and acting continues to be top notch as well. I mean, I definitely, I don't, because like I kind of want to be like, well, for Walking Dead, reading the comics definitely took my enjoyment of the show, because every time they zigged where the show zagged, I felt like it was always a worse zig or a worse zag than the comic books.
And it almost felt always, like they did it only to zag. They didn't have any intention other than let's not zig here.
There's also, you think we're going to zig, we're going to subvert the zag. Also, is this going to cost money? If not, let's keep zigging, right. Even if we're sick of the zig location, because we got the zig factory for 4 years and we got to amortize this shit and get a load of the zig. But like, you know, The Expanse was a lot more like, I guess, his jazz style remix, especially for the first two or three books. So I've seen it done both ways. The Game of Thrones was pretty literal for the first three or four seasons before they kind of ran out of track. So, and it's like, man, I think about Game of Thrones, and I thought that was impressive in season one. But I know when you and I went back and did a rewatch, like, if you are used to the highs and the confidence of the production from like season four and five and six of Game of Thrones, and you go back to season one, where there's still a little bit of that pilot footage left, and it's rough.
Yeah,
it's rough for hair and makeup, costuming, dialogue. Like, you know, they needed to gel a bit, right?
Yeah. No, I'm super interested to see what happens with this 137 year time jump, because that to me, the first book never even gets that far. The first book gets 80 years into this process, and it's gone. The Foundation has gone through three iterations at that point. The Foundation has gone from this backwater galactopedia thing into a full blown religion, into a full blown mercantile operation. Like it has changed fundamentally multiple times. We're going to jump ahead 137 years, and I don't expect them to be any further along than like a religion, if that.
Yeah. I wonder if they're going to just slow everything down in general, like to get this eight. So like, you know, to like, you know, really make a, because we were thinking of like, well, you know, a book, a season. And David said, no, that's not the way to look at it at all. So it could just be that they're just going to take a little bit more time, like, for whatever reason, to let the Empire look a little bit more fucked up, or I don't know, because you're right. Like in the span of time, the books that covers, like, the Foundation does go through a radical number of upheavals and changes.
And I feel like it's almost too compressed in the books. Like 80 years is not enough time for this organization to become the three things it is.
Yeah. And so, like, I guess I wouldn't tell people not to read these books. I guess like, at this point in the season, I don't know why you would start. But like, sometimes people prefer to read a book after the series, because, you know, then it almost feels like you're always expanding your knowledge and you're getting like more detail and more lore. And you don't feel like, you know, that you're getting a abbreviated version. But it'll be interesting because I think people will be really surprised at how stilted some of the stuff is in Foundation, you know, from a storytelling, just a narrative standpoint. Like, there's nothing as colorful as the genetic dynasty.
No.
There's nothing like the simple human connection of Hugo and Salvor or her parents. You know, there's nothing like a war, like a, you know, there's none of that stuff.
No, it's a bunch of dudes sitting around in rooms talking is essentially, there are a couple scenes that are a little more exciting than that, but very few.
Is there a lot of smoking in those books too? Like conspicuous smoking?
I think so.
Okay, because I heard that somebody saying that's one of the jarring things is like how often people are like ashing into like, you know, atomic disintegrators or whatever. So that's kind of jarring that we're still Marlboro manning up at 20, 30,000 years into Galactic Empire. But yeah. I don't know, because like I don't feel like this is a like usually when you see a book and you then you see the movie, you think of, oh, that's just the toned down, stripped down version. Mm-hmm. If anything, like there's so much expanded on in this series, it feels like the opposite. So,
yeah,
it'll be interesting. I feel like if you read the book first and you think that the show is going to be like that, you might be in a bad time for a bad time. But I also think if you watch the show and then read the book, it might also be like, oh, man, it's a little, you know, it's like if you like the movie Dune, hey, let's go watch the David Lynch Dune. I bet you don't like the David Lynch Dune. I bet most people that really like the Denis Villeneuve will probably not like the David Lynch, but you probably like the book. So yeah. I do think that listening to the official podcast and seeing all the different interviews and comments that they've made, the writing staff, it does feel like they're very bright, smart people with interesting things to say about humanity. And I do think it's crazy how much shit that they get on like the subreddit, especially like insults to their intelligence. Like it, you can say whatever you want. Like these are pretty talented, creative, smart folk, you know, like, oh, they personally offended your calculations of hyperspace. I'm sorry. they also created a really nifty version of warp drive I've never seen before. So there's that.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll see. We'll see. You know, I just want this to be first and foremost a good show. And so far, I think it's a good show that's had a lot of things that are great about it and has a lot of promise for the future. So
me too.
Foundation at baldmove.com. If you want to disagree with us or agree with us, or you got a new take, a new theory, something you want to share, like Dumbledore and Harry Seldon, totally related, I would love to hear it. Foundation of baldmove.com. We'll see you Thursday late evening or early Friday morning for episode 9, the penultimate episode, the first crisis. Speaking of crises.
Yeah.
I can't wait. I can actually watch the episode now. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.